Welcome to another episode of People, Pets, and Purpose podcast, a show about the human-animal bond and what really matters. I'm your host, Diaz Dixon, the Maddie's Advisor for External Affairs and Partnerships for the Human-Animal Support Service Project. Today, I'm super excited to welcome my friend and the Executive Director of the National Animal Care and Control Association, Jerrica Owen. At Haas, we're always discussing how field services, also known as animal control officers, really are the heroic first responders to all animal welfare issues in the community. Today, we want to use our discussion to better understand their role in public service and how we, as a community, can support them as they work to maintain the human-animal bond. And yes, we are thrilled to have you here, Jerrica. Thank you for coming on to People, Pets, and Purpose.
Hi, everybody. Thank you so much for having me. I'm super excited to be here.
Well, it's always good when we've got heroes jumping onto our show, you know, people who are doing stuff behind the scenes. Let's jump on into the basics. What is NACA, N-A-C-A, and how does it support both people and pets?
All right. So NACA, National Animal Care and Control Association. For anyone not familiar with us, we are a national nonprofit, and we're really dedicated to setting the standards of professionalism for animal care and control officers across the United States. We provide training. We have a national certification course, a basic and an advanced, and soon to be a third. We also provide resources to animal control professionals. Our primary focus is really on empowering professionals in this space to effectively and compassionately enforce animal-related laws, to respond to animal-related emergencies, and furthermore, really just promote that healthy relationship that pets have with their owners, right? And then that goes into the idea of healthy communities and kind of supporting all of it.
That's awesome, especially when you talk about healthy communities, because a lot of times when we're thinking about these particular services and things that are done, unless you're in the field of animal welfare, you don't even recognize that. There's an old, outdated idea in the field that field service officers are simply dog catchers. And I know that Vincent Medley, a good friend of both of ours, gets so mad, you know, gets so riled up when he hears that. Particularly when a lost pet gets loose. Can you paint a more accurate picture for us what field service officers offer to our community?
Yeah, absolutely. So, some people may have heard me say this before, but Disney, right, has done a really amazing job of sort of vilifying and stereotyping the role of animal control. But we know that officers do so much more than that, right? Field service officers, animal control officers, they go by a million different titles, but they really do play that sort of crucial role in the community, simply beyond simply just catching those loose pets. So animal control officers are highly trained professionals who are dedicated to ensuring that the safety and well-being of both the animals and the people, right? And so a more accurate picture, I guess, of what they would be doing and what they do is to say that they're focused on animal welfare and safety, right? They respond to calls related to cruelty, neglect, abuse, ensuring that the animals are protected from harm and provided with the appropriate care, right? So they also, in addition to enforcing sort of local animal control ordinances and regulations, simple things like leash laws, nuisance complaints, that kind of stuff. So that's sort of kind of what we, right, the traditional and what we know that they do and what they are required to do. But some of the other things they do, promote this healthy relationship between pets and their owners. They talk daily with the community about pet ownership practices, things like licensing or vaccinating, really, getting to the root of proper care and really help to promote the health and welfare of pets, which then goes right into that sort of, reduction in the number of stray animals in a community. More proactive than your traditional reactive way that we've been kind of thought to, that we've thought about it in the past. They also do community outreach and education. So engaging with the communities, whether that be at outreach events, school programs, maybe public presentations, anything that helps raise awareness about the animal welfare issues, promote adoptions, maybe promote fostering, really things that continue to support the positive relationship between the pets and their people.
That shows a really clear link. Such a wide array of services that are offered, wide array of benefits and education that goes into helping the community. It's more and more people, and particularly kids, to be looking at this because it's a wonderful field to go into. Tell us a little bit more, Jerrica, about your background and how did you get involved with DACA? I mean, we want to know why your passion is rooted in field services.
Yeah, so I've actually been in sheltering for over 20 years, which I don't like saying that
Wow,
out loud.
20 years. You know what? Your time in animal services can almost drink.
Almost. So yeah, long time, right? Variety of different roles. I spent a majority of my time with an organization right out of college. I was the part-time mobile adoptions counselor, and I would drive the big RV full of pets to the local pet stores for adoption days and stuff. And I had a great time. It was wonderful. I really was able to start in a good spot, I think, to kind of see all the different pieces of sheltering. So kind of, long story short, I worked there for a very long time. And my last role was the senior leadership level, and we were supporting and working through contract negotiations with one of the largest city governments in the US. Also overseeing disaster response efforts for the organization. I've always been one that really likes to get in there, right? Get my hands dirty. I love to be the boots on the ground. So I also did quite a few deployments during hurricanes. We also supported
Wow.
with large-scale cases for the organization or for partner organizations. So a lot of things like that. And so I think this was just a natural progression for me to come to NACA, although I didn't really see it at the time. But it's although I never necessarily worked as an animal control officer, I was always side by side with the humane law enforcement teams and the animal control officer teams. And what I always saw was that there was just this gap, right? These two, the field services and your shelter kind of tend to operate as silos. And I've seen this in my own personal journey as well as when I talk to others. And so I saw, and I still see the opportunity to really divide, to really bridge this gap. And the roles are very different, and that's okay. But there's a lot of alignment and cohesion in all the things that happen, and so it's all interconnectedness. And quite honestly, field services are out in the community every day, right? They're that sort of centerpiece, and kind of everything else kind of goes around it. So that's sort of how I see it, and I really do what I can within my role here and given my experience to really try and help promote and elevate, right, officers and all the great work that they're doing.
That's really cool. That's really cool. Well, you were just touching on a little bit about the deployments that you've done. Is there one in particular that sticks out for you? And what was that like? So what is it, talking to our audience that doesn't understand what that actually means, particularly people outside of animal welfare, tell us a little bit about those deployments and if there's one that sticks out in your mind.
Yeah, absolutely. Hurricane Harvey, I think, was probably one of the most impactful ones. There was a couple before that, but that one was a big one. And we left the West Coast in an RV and a group of us, and we headed down to help out in the southern part of Texas. And it's challenging. You're in a disaster zone, and if you're not from an area, like I'm not from an area that experiences a ton of natural disaster, and
Right.
so kind of putting yourself in that space is right mentally and physically challenging. Even just the weather, right? It was so hot, so trying to work through all of that. But it's really interesting. I definitely encourage anybody who hasn't deployed to work with one of the deploying agencies. So there's American Humane or ASPCA, HSUS. So all of them have some training required and then some deployment teams. And for animal control officers in particular, their role is might be very different during a disaster because they're still having to enforce. They're still having to take on, helping to reunite pets with their owners and stuff like that. So, shameless plug for the NACA training. There is a whole disaster module coming out in our ACO 2 in
Oh,
another
wow.
couple of weeks. Yeah, so we built a disaster module to kind of lay the groundwork of the basics of disaster work and then the animal control officer role specifically and how it is impacted during disaster and what that role might look like and what things you need to be trained on. So yeah, it's times of disaster is stressful for all, but it is a really great way to give back to the community to kind of see things from a different perspective and really just have a kind of a different view on things.
Yeah, that's really cool. Well, and thank you for all that hard work that you have done and continued to put in. We know that often field officers are the first line of defense in animal welfare. And we don't tip the average person that has no idea about that because we only see shelters. What are the challenges that are most often seen in the field, and how does that impact animal sheltering?
Yeah, field officers often serve as those frontline responders in animal welfare. And they'll face a variety of challenges, right? Things that are impacting people and the pets. A couple of the common challenges, we've talked about this before, but like stray and loose animals, right? Field officers frequently respond to calls about the stray running at large. And these animals, may be abandoned, they may be lost, they may be potentially a public safety risk. And so, that's something that they see. So how managing that. And then now, typically they were just catching them and bringing them back to the shelter. Now we're in a space of trying to work through reunification in the field, right? How do we not even put those pets in the shelter?
Not even make it to the shelter. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Other things, they'll come across cruelty cases, neglect cases, animal hoarding cases, things like that. And those really impact officers physically themselves, right? Some of
Right.
that stuff is very challenging to see, very challenging to deal with. It's a lot of times I think we don't talk about it enough. And I know it's a problem because I see it all over, right, on people's Facebook pages or on the animal control Facebook pages where they are so stressed out and they're not getting the support and they don't feel comfortable talking about things. And so how can we help support the officers to be comfortable with taking time for themselves and being okay with needing some time and space for themselves? So I know that that's a big challenge. But overall, the challenges faced by field officers are really multifaceted and they're interconnected. Things that impact people impact the pets and vice versa, which then, right, impacts your whole communities.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, and the importance of having really good self-care
Yes.
and taking care of your mental health in those positions. Would you say that field officers probably felt a little more resistance over the last number of years when we were having issues and struggles going on with law enforcement? Did field officers, would you say that they felt a little bit of that impact?
I think so. I would. It's definitely a tough role to be in. And they tend to be, and this is sort of just, I don't want to say a generalization, but this is just kind of what I hear, that the animal control officers are expected to perform a public service, right, within the community. However, in many of the communities, they are not given the same resources, tools, and respect as as law enforcement. And yet they're still having to deal with the same community who is maybe not trusting of the police. Now they're not trusting of the officers. And so they have a lot of the same, they run into some of those same challenges and some of those same situations. And then the officers tend to not be as supported by their agency, or by their coworkers and stuff like that. So it's really complicated, unfortunately. but it's something that we think is very important, is to continue to professionalize and to push the standardization, and to, you know, make it to where officers are that valued and respected public service provider in their community and thought so as such.
That's very cool. You know, and you know, because it's a tough job to do, particularly when the community doesn't have a lot of trust in systems in general. I've heard you talk about the shift. Jerrica, you've talked about the shift in the industry towards compassionate enforcement. And I think that that is something that probably helps better serve people in need. What is compassionate enforcement? Tell us a little bit.
Yeah, I really like that term. It really represents a significant, I think, evolution in how the animal control agencies approach their work. So, right, traditionally, we've been very enforcement focused, solely on enforcing laws, regulations, very punitive, citations, fines, removal of animals, things like that. And I don't want to be misunderstood, right? There are definitely times where that is the most humane and the most effective method. And there are things that must happen. But in a lot of cases, this compassionate enforcement really recognizes that addressing the root cause of animal welfare issues really requires more of a holistic and empathetic approach, understanding the underlying factors that contribute to animal-related problems, things like lack of access to resources, lack of mental health access for humans, social inequities, poverty, right? Rather than solely relying on these punitive measures, when compassionate enforcement practices kind of seek to empower the individuals in the communities to provide proper care for their animals by addressing those kind of root causes that maybe down the line are things that are going to contribute to, an unintentional neglect or cruelty. When agencies and officers sort of adopt this compassionate approach, they really are able to better serve their communities because they can support them with resources, right? Instead of immediately resorting to punitive, they can talk to them about, what do you need? How can we help? Again, getting to sort of that root cause of some of these issues, empowering pet owners, right? Talking to pet owners about proper care, you can actually help prevent future problems and build those stronger relationships between the pets and their people, between the agency and the officer and the pets and the people, which brings me to the next one, which is trust, right? You're building trust. You're working through collaborative efforts. Maybe there's a veterinarian in the community who you can kind of get involved that can help with some of these, you know, different programs. You're really promoting, you know, equity and social justice. Compassionate enforcement acknowledges sort of this intersectionality, as I mentioned before, and kind of working through and breaking down barriers.
That's really beautiful, you know, the intersectionality. And you're talking about trust, because trust is one of those things that has to be built with intentionality. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't, I say all the time, it's one of those things, it's one of the few things in the world that never sits static. It's either being built or broken. Mm-hmm. And, you know, oftentimes what messaging is happening on the radio or on television and the media, whatever it may be, oftentimes are breaking trust simply. And it's important that with intentionality, which is what I love, everything that you're saying about compassion enforcement, it's about really meeting people where they're at, diving into their communities and understand them. That's super cool. Good stuff. Good stuff.
Yeah. It just represents, right, a more humane, effective, and a sustainable approach that really prioritizes empathy and collaboration and engagement, and really just gets to that root of how can we better serve the people and the pets with a purpose. See what I did there?
I like it. I do. I love it. That's a great little hook for a commercial coming up here. I love it. Well, tell us, Jerrica, why don't you walk us through how someone might become NACA certified? What does that entail, and why are these trainings so important to maintaining that human-animal bond?
Yeah, so becoming NACA certified, nationally certified, right, involves the training course, the passing of the exam, and essentially the continuing education unit. So just like any other profession, we want our animal control officers to work continuously work, right? There's, if there's one thing, our field is constantly and always changing. And so how do we stay, you know, current and updated? And so our training courses used to be many, many years ago and prior to COVID were in person. Since COVID, we've actually switched them to online, which we've seen a very large increase in the amount of officers who are actually able to take the training because it's self-paced, because it doesn't have the barriers of travel funds or travel in general. You know, a lot of ACOs are the only animal control officer in 10 counties and can't leave. And so it's really been, we've been able to, again, with the root cause of officers not having training, right? And one of the root causes is there's maybe no training budget or there's no training, that includes travel. And so how can we, so this has actually been really good. And so our ACO 1 is more of the basic. Our ACO 2 is advanced. ACO 2 will be re-released. It is out now, but it will be re-released with 5 new modules towards the end of April 2024 or early May 2024. And then soon to be ACO 3, which will be a hybrid with the University of Florida in Gainesville.
Wow.
Yeah, super exciting. So, you know, our certification, not only our certification, but any certification, right? It's really important because it helps with professionalism, as I've mentioned. You know, officers need to demonstrate really high levels of professionalism and competency, which goes right back to what we were just talking about with that trust, right? If your community doesn't trust you because you don't have the training necessary or have the skills that you learn from the training, then you may, you know, start to break some trust. So, also effective response, making sure that you understand, how to respond effectively when various situations happen, right? Involving emergencies, maybe cruelty cases or nuisance complaints. Well-trained certified officers really provide, that level of, support to their communities that, again, go back to the building of trust.
Yeah. Very cool. That's good stuff.
Yeah. Good stuff.
Well, you know, it's important to note for listeners out there that this particular episode is going to be airing during ACO Appreciation Week, which is April 14th through the 20th. So, Jerrica, what kind of advice could you give the listeners on how they might be supportive of field officer work? And how we can show some appreciation. Any suggestions that you have?
Yeah, absolutely. So I love ACO Week. Yay.
All right.
It's so important to show gratitude and support for anybody that works in this space. But we know that the officers sometimes are out in the field and they may miss the pizza party is what I hear, or they're not able to participate in something because they, you know, have to be out in the field or something. So, you know, even just simple thank you notes, you know, expressing gratitude can go a really long way. Helping to advocate for resources, things, you know, they need certain tools and certain equipment and proper uniforms. And some just don't have that. So how can we help to advocate for resources?
Right.
Working, even donating supplies, you know, asking your community for certain supplies that you need.
Continuing a little ACO drive.
Yeah. Do a little ACO drive, all the things.
Yeah,
NECA has we put out a fun calendar for this year. So it'll be, it's like pizza Thursday and nacho average age ACO on Monday. So do a nacho bar. So we kind of did some fun stuff for agencies this year if they need help with ideas. And a toolkit that has a variety of things you can print. Like you can just print the flyers and post them up. There's note cards in there. Certificates of appreciation. So we kind of tried to take the lift off some of the agencies and provide them some of these tools that they can just print off easy. So
very cool. Some great ideas right there. Well, I would be remiss if I didn't ask my favorite question that I have that I ask for every guest. Tell us about any fur babies that you have.
I have a fur baby and I have a hard-shelled reptile baby.
That's right. I had heard about your hard-shelled reptile. I forgot to ask you about that. Do tell.
Okay. So my fur baby, her name is Kaya, and she's a lab mix. She's 13. She's getting up there. She's still but happy and loves to go for long walks and very active, kind of acts like a puppy sometimes, but she's getting to be my old lady. And I have a 30, I want to say 33-year-old desert tortoise.
Okay. All
Yeah.
right. And how does that work for you in the with hibernating and throughout the year?
She sleeps from Halloween to Easter. So if you ask my husband, it's the best pet ever because she's only awake half the year. And the other half the year, like right now, she woke up a couple weeks ago and she just, we've got a, you know, decent sized backyard. So she just cruises around the backyard. She nibbles on the grass. She nibbles on some of the, we grow like some weeds in the garden for her. And so she nibbles on those. She eats flowers. You know, we give her some treats. So it's great. And whoever says reptiles don't have a personality hasn't had one, because they are so much fun. Such a personality. She is very social, which I didn't realize that they could be social, but she's very social. It's the best.
She comes
I love
to
it.
You when she sees you in the yard, she actually comes hauling your way, right?
Totally. And she's quick. She's not slow.
Okay, that's pretty good. That's pretty good. Breaking preconceived notions one reptile at a time. So that's pretty good, Jerrica. That's awesome. I want to thank you so much for coming on the show today. We wish you nothing but the best as we celebrate this great ACO week. And I know you guys out there, you can't see because this is, you know, all audio, but I get a chance to watch Jerrica, and you would think it was the biggest Shark Week nerd. When you see Shark Week get fired up, she got really fired up at ACO Appreciation Week. So let's make sure that we get out there and we spread the word. And also for you listeners, thank you so much for joining us for another episode of People, Pets, and Purpose. We hope that you will learn more about the National Animal Care and Control Association by visiting their website. And that website is, Jerrica?
www.nacanet.org.
And always, you can find additional field service support at humananimalsupportservices.org. We're super happy to continue to support you. Thank you for doing this wonderful work in the world that needs more human kindness and pet kindness altogether. So we'll see you next time. Take care.